Welcome everyone to Animal Voices. Yes, thank you for that call of the rooster. That should make all the hens come and listen to Animal Voices. The primary source of the foods we eat and the air we breathe comes from plants. And the great poet Hesiod wrote, "As long as man continues to be the ruthless destroyer of lower living beings, he will never know health or peace. For as long as men massacre animals, they will kill each other. Indeed, he who sows the seed of murder and pain cannot reap joy and love." Animal Voices seeks to enlighten the general public on animal-related causes. We do this by presenting and producing a radio program that delivers a message that inspires people to improve the lives of animals. You're listening to Animal Voices coming to you on CFRO Radio 102.7 FM in Vancouver, your community-based and community-sponsored radio station. Alan Jensen is in the control room. My name is Carl Loskin. And in the studio today, we have John Pranger, who often represents the Animal Defense and Vivisection Society. John, last week we had a superb program where you were the host and you had one person on there for a complete hour. Just give us a little recap of what that was all about.
Thanks, Carl. Yeah, that was Dr. Ray Greek, and he's written several books on the subject that I also work with in my small way, but he does in his big way. And we had him on last week to field your calls and answer your questions. And really, my idea and his is to expose the fraud of animal research because it damages human health. And it produces deadly drugs and inapplicable theories and provides the pharmaceutical and chemical industries with an alibi that allows them to test drugs and chemicals on animals, which is inconclusive for human beings, and then allows them to market it. So that's basically the message that he brought and that he conveys so intelligently and fascinatingly, I think, in his books. And I urge you to read them. And you can go to his website at curedisease.com, and the MP3 of that conversation that we have with Dr. Greek is available on our website at animalvoices.org.
Well, you know, not only did Dr. Ray Greek bring out so many of the issues here, which were totally new to me, to discover what is the just behind this enormous expansion of animal experimentation in the universities and everywhere, and the reliance of science that is very questionable. And you know, John, what you did so wonderfully in that program was you asked these questions and you brought it out from Dr. Ray Greek in California, who is the preeminent person to speak on what we call vivisection. Vivisection is animal experimentation and the absolute cruelty that is perpetrated every day in universities and hospitals everywhere. Well, in today's program, we also have Marge Adams right here. Hello, Marge.
Hi, Carl, and thank you. I want to ask our listeners to support the Chicken Out campaign. If you buy eggs, please choose certified organic. Any other terms, such as free range, access to the outdoors, etc., are simply advertising terms. So when you go shopping, help the chickens by buying the outside chickens, the chickens that are not in battery hen cages. And that those are always labeled certified organic. That's the only way you can be sure that you are getting the or supporting the hens. Thanks, Carl.
Yes, and you know, in the studio today, we have also Anthony Marr, and we'll be over. He's going to be our keynote speaker here in the studio today for the first half an hour anyway. And Anthony Marr has just returned from Japan, and he has a host of different subjects he'd like to deal with, and we'll try and raise those issues, and we'll learn from him what he's been doing on a very grassroots kind of level. And then at the half-hour mark, we will contact Helen Matthews, who is the co-founder of the Boston Eco-Feminist Organization. And she's been working on connecting social justice and animal liberation issues. And she's been doing this. Let me just repeat that. Social justice and animal liberation. What do they have in common? And she's been doing that and presenting doing presentations at schools and universities for the past 5 years. Well, we have Anthony Marr, who is well known to Animal Voices because he likes to come in and he likes to travel all over the world with a world of knowledge. Anthony Marr is basically well known for his involvement with protecting animals, animals in peril, animals which have been victimized by human greed and cruelty. Well, sad to know that that's still happening in this world. Anthony, tell us about what's new on your horizon.
Thank you, first of all, for inviting me back in here again. What is new is actually nothing new at all. It's been going on for centuries. Basically, what I've been paying attention to, both in terms of the Japanese whaling, in terms of a dolphin slaughter, dolphin capture, probably is new because the aquarium scene is relatively new, but dolphin slaughter for meat has certainly been going on for centuries, and the Canadian seal hunt has been going on for a couple of hundred years at least. So we're talking about old stuff, but there was something new in there, and I could get into that later.
Right, but you know, the seal hunt, the seal slaughter, let's call that the seal slaughter, because what do you symbolize with a hunt? That means that the animals have a fair chance, isn't it? Or what's the difference between a hunt and a slaughter?
Well, the word hunt nowadays usually indicates that the animals have no chance whatsoever. Given the high-powered weapons, first of all, instead of bows and arrows, as in olden days, and also canned hunts, whaling, the whales have no chance. Dolphins are herded into bays, they've got no chance. Seals, of course, have to give birth to pups, and pups have to sit on the ice, and they've got no chance whatsoever. So hunting is has become I don't know what derogatory term I can put to it, except that the word hunting is basically a there was no fair play in it whatsoever.
No fair play. But we're going to be protesting. We'll have this little announcement here because it's going to be the International Day of Action for Seals, and that's going to be on Wednesday, March the 15th. Are you familiar with this? Last year, before we talk about the event coming up on March the 15th at between 12 and 2 p.m. outside the Department of Fisheries, I wanted to tell you, Anthony, how wonderful it was for me to go to last year's SEAL event, because it was not just a protest. You know, there was something magic about that, and it, even in its sadness, there was beauty in it, because maybe use your own words and tell us what happened there. There was the they closed off the road, and there was a reenactment. Use your own words.
Well, my own words have been taken out of my mouth by you just now.
Finally.
Anyway, it is a wonderful event, wonderful in the sense that it is a hallmark event, I would say. Wonderful not in the sense of what it is protesting. What it is protesting is of course, the antithesis of being wonderful. Something really wonderful about that event is that it's outside of the event, or something greater than the event to which the event belongs. Of course, the seal hunt protests have been going on for, you know, decades. But last year has something new to it, because last year there is a concerted effort by a large number of groups around the world, led by some huge groups, particularly the Humane Society of the United States and the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society, these two. But many, many countries are participating in it for the first time, together in cooperation, in harmony. In the United States alone, I believe there are about 27, 28 cities doing this hunt, all on March the 15th. BC is spectacular in the sense that usually in a state or in a country, there's only one city doing it. But in BC, Vancouver and Kelowna, two cities are doing it. So BC is outstanding in that fashion.
So now, Captain Paul Watson will be doing the presentation in Los Angeles, and we'll be here on March the 15th, as we said before, outside the Department of Fisheries and Oceans, on 401 West Burrard. 401 West Burrard, that's the cross street is West Hastings. And so between 12 and 2 p.m. And there's going to be, like last year, there was a reenactment of the seal slaughter. It was so moving because you had these dolphins, these people dressed up as dolphins, and then there was this, you know, the dolphins moving around gracefully. And I'm speaking as from one who's sat on the rocks in the southern part of Africa and watched dolphins joyfully, you know, bouncing, leaping out of the ocean, and such a happy sight. And I saw it here on the tarmac, and then the eventual stabbing, and you know, but this year there's going to be a similar event here, and we're going to ask people to come out to this event because there's going to be a special way of making this known. And so it's not just going to be people standing there with placards. So we'll mention this later on the event again. Anyway, Anthony, you've come back from Japan, and you said there was a connection between the whaling and Walmart. So how did you discover this, and what is this all about?
It is not immediately obvious, actually, when you look into the whaling industry. It has to take two or three turns before you get to that. But once you get to the Walmart connection, you will see how powerful this connection is. Of course, Japan has been killing whales in large numbers for years and years and years. Japan is the leading whaling nation in the world. The whaling, according to the International Whaling Commission, is not allowed. But there are some loopholes, and Japan is doing its utmost, of course, to exploit the loophole of scientific research whaling. When I went to Japan, to the city of Shimonoseki, where the whaling fleet assembled shortly before it departed, there was no problem at all identifying the whaling mothership, because there was this huge, in block letters, research painted on the side of the ship. So. And then, of course, when you go to the stern of the ship, you see the slipway where they drag the whales up into onto the deck to be dismembered. And Paul Watson very delicately calls that as the anus of the ship, that the ship is feeding through its anus.
And, except that the whales are going in.
The whales are going in through the rear end. And it's worth 2 or 3 seconds laugh, but then it's a very sad situation, of course. And so Japan is using that loophole, scientific research whaling. I have been looking through the internet to find some Japanese research reports, and I have up to this point not found one single report. And of course, the most important research analysis that they should do is to analyze the contaminants inside the whale meat. And, of course, that is not a part of that research, but it is done by independent scientists. And I want to see if I'm leaping ahead of myself, but there is a supermarket chain, similar to the Japanese equivalent of Safeway in Canada, called Seiyu. That's S-E-I-Y-U. It's got about 430 or 440 outlets throughout Japan, in all major cities and minor cities. And a research has been done by a group called Environmental Investigation Agency in Britain. They surveyed all the Seiyu outlets, which are supermarkets. They found that whale meat is available for sale throughout the whale, Seiyu outlets, maybe 95% plus of them. And so that is one fact. Fact number two is that they also have been sampling these whale meat, and some of the whale meat, which are dark in color, almost black, are disguised dolphin meat, disguised as whale meat. And they have been spot checking all of these randomly, and almost uniformly they find a high level of chemical contamination, particularly heavy metals, particularly mercury. And dioxins, which are the dioxins, are the most potent carcinogens known to science. PCB, everybody know about PCBs. Mercury is particularly damaging to the central nervous system, particularly the brain of fetuses and young children. There's another country which is a little bit more conscientious about human health, anyway, than Japan, which who is also a whaling nation, and that is Norway. Norway is more conscientious in Japan than Japan in that it openly warns its citizens, particularly the pregnant women and young children, to not to ingest any whale meat that they so-called harvest from the ocean. And Japan, on the other hand, is not only openly promoting whale meat in all its supermarkets, labeling it as health food, and I have photos to prove it. Whale meat, health food. It is also actively introducing whale meat into school lunch programs in elementary schools throughout Japan. Hundreds of schools have this whale meat lunch. And this whale meat in school in school programs, in their brochure, calls the whale meat brain enhancers.
Brain enhancers.
So if children ingest the whale meat, I can guarantee you they will take in a lot of mercury and dioxins and PCBs, and they will show, if they're young enough, brain damage that is irreversible. Now, irreversible has been proven because there is another place called the Faroe Islands, which is a protectorate of Denmark, which has an annual tradition called the grind, in which they drive pilot whales into the bays, and then they slaughter them with whatever weapons are available. They also invite tourists to participate in the slaughtering of these pilot whales. And so some scientists went to the Faroe Islands and did some research on the meat of the pilot whales that these people eat. They divide the people into two groups, one group eating whale meat, one group not eating whale meat, particularly pregnant women. And then 7 years later, they analyze the brain capacity and the behavior and the abilities of the children 7 years old from these pregnant women. And then seven more years, when they're 14 years old, they study them again. And they found, of course, that the group of children whose mothers ingested whale meat have very, very noticeable and sometimes severe brain damage, behavioral problems, speech impediments, motor skill problems, and the 14-year-old group have the same problems. So that proves that not only do they have these health effects are irreversible.
Now, Minamata's disease, is that correct? Did I say that correctly? It was, of course, well known in Japan, with many people being contaminated with mercury. But I have two questions here. One is, have you any idea how many whales were captured by the Japanese and the Norwegians in 1 year? And the other question is, with the International Whaling Commission, they're somehow or other getting other countries, small countries like the Caribbean countries, financing them to vote on their behalf,
right,
to legalize this slaughter of whales. So first of all, what's the figures on this?
Okay, Japan, I'm not sure about Norway, but Japan, the figures that I give you about Japan would be greater than the figures for Norway. Japan, up to about last year, they would go down to the Antarctic and they've got a self-set quota of 440 minke whales. And these are smaller whales, about 20 tons each. And this year they have unilaterally decided, without anybody's approval, to double that number up to about 800 and 900. And plus they're adding two more species to it. One is the I believe, sei whale or fin whale, and the other one is the humpback whale. The humpback whale is, of course, the world's darling. Everybody loves humpback whales. And humpback whales are considered to be endangered, but Japan has once again brutally, without anybody's consent, unilaterally included the humpback whale and the fin whale into their so-called harvest quota. I think it's about a couple of hundred of those, and that is between November and April. By April, they would return to Japan, unload the whale meat, and within 2 or 3 weeks, they would go out again, the fleet, together with coastal whaling ships, which are smaller, to pillage the whales in the Japanese waters, and that includes about three or four species of whales, the sei whale, the Brude's whale, and the sperm whale, which is the, of course, Moby Dick species. And these whales are very easy to catch. When I was in Japan, I went to Fudo, where they used to kill dolphins, and they have resumed killing dolphins. And that hero fisherman who turned into a whale-watching operator, Mr. Ishii Izumi, took me out on his boat and gave me a whale-watching experience of only 1 hour and a half. And within half an hour, we found two sperm whales within sight of land. So they just they're just very easy to catch and kill, and there was no heroism in it, none at all.
Now let's get back to the whaling commission. How the Japanese are thwarting the validity of this organization to protect whales. What's happening there? What's the voting there? Are they saying that's okay now? Have they got enough votes there to legalize this? Are they happy with calling it scientific purposes and getting away with it? What's happening?
Well, they've been calling it scientific whaling for years and years and years and getting away with it. The International Whaling Commission has the weakness of its system, its voting system. It's one country, one vote. It doesn't matter if it's China with 1.4, 1.5 billion people, or a Caribbean nation with several hundred thousand people or 1 or 2 million people. Each one would be worth one vote. And these Caribbean nations are small, and they're poor, and Japan is powerful and rich, and they're very easy to bribe. So Japan is sending emissaries out to the Caribbean nations and some African coastal nations to buy their vote. And every single year they're making more and more headway, and I'm sure that one of these years they would get enough of these bought votes to get a majority, and then whaling will open again legally.
Now, one further question about the sale of whale meat in Japan. You mentioned that it was for sale in Sayu. Now, you also mentioned that some North American companies are involved in sale of whale meat there. Is that correct?
That is correct.
You want to mention any names here?
Well, its nickname is Whalemart.
Oh, Whalemart.
And its real name is Walmart.
Really?
And okay. Walmart... And I didn't know about it until this last year, actually, and I should have known it for longer than that. Walmart and Seiyu are so interwoven that they're practically inseparable. They share their own directors, they share their own executives, they share their own policies, and they own each other's shares. Walmart owns, last time I read, it was Walmart owns about 37.5%. of Seiyu. And so it is exceedingly powerful in forming Seiyu policies. And in other words, Walmart is a driving force in whaling and in the whale meat trade industry. And of course, that would drive whaling. So Walmart is almost directly responsible in part, other than together with Seiyu and other whale meat merchants in driving the whaling industry.
We're talking with Anthony Marr, who is a well-known person because of his involvement for protecting animals in peril. And we've been listening to how he's been on guard for the whales and letting people know what it is all about. We just have a few minutes left, and then we're going to spend the rest of the hour with you, but in between, we have Helen Matthews going to be on the line. So thank you for staying for the full hour. We want to hear more about what you've been doing. But we have a couple of minutes here, and then could you tell us, because you're going on tour throughout the United States, and you earlier said that you're better known in the United States than in Canada. We'll cover some of the aspects of your letter to our new Prime Minister here, and... Why is it you're better known in the United States, and what are you going to be doing on your tour of the United States? You're leaving within a few weeks.
Well, actually, I've been forced to change my schedule to July, actually, and a longer one. Originally, I planned to do it between March and May, and covering only the western states. However, the other states are... Sort of wondering why I'm not going to them. So they wrote me lots of emails and say, you know, so I finally have decided to sort of integrate everything into a longer tour, 5 months long, from July until December. and it will include in August in Washington, D.C., the Animal Rights Conference. And what's the question?
Well, you're well known there in the Animal Rights Convention.
The reason why I go down
there,
is that...
Washington, D.C., don't forget to speak to the... to the people there, you know, the little antenna going over to Pennsylvania Avenue.
Oh, yes,
they
definitely
need to hear the message, too. And I hear you're quite close to there. But be close to the hearts and be close to the ears. Well, we're going to have a little bit of music with Alan Jensen, and over to Alan. And we'll be back with Anthony Marr. You're listening to Animal Voices. Our webpage is www.animalvoices.org. Many of our programs can be heard there on this and by kind... work from our webmaster, John Pranger, www.animalvoices.org. Over to Alan Jensen. It's the halfway mark, and welcome back to Animal Voices. In this program, we seek to enlighten the general public about animal-related causes. And we do this by presenting a program, a radio program that delivers a message that inspires people to improve the lives of animals. Well, we deal with many different aspects of animal rights and human rights and issues that come to the fore. And today it's our very special privilege to contact Helen Matthews, who is the co-founder of a grassroots Boston eco-feminist organization. And they've been working towards making the connection between social justice and animal liberation. Let me just repeat that. Yes, it's they're making the connection between social justice and animal liberation. That may seem far-fetched to you, but here we have Helen Matthews to tell us all about it. Welcome to Animal Voices.
Hi, thank you.
Well, you know, you have this wonderful webpage, and maybe you can just explain to us a little bit about what we have, the feminists, have in common with the animals.
Right. There has been a growing consciousness of how the treatment of women may be connected to the treatment of animals. So some people lately have been talking about how sexism is connected to the subjugation of other animals. And there are many ways currently that plays out. And honestly, we could probably get into a rather detailed conversation about any one of these ways, but right now I'll just give you a general overview. So, for example, reproductive control, that's one of the main issues on the feminist agenda, at least here in the United States, and especially right now we're having a sort of a crisis in reproductive freedom here. And that actually is a form of oppression that greatly affects non-human animals in various different industries, from vivisection to factory farming. So that's one way. Another way is domestic violence. Some people have been doing some research lately into how the abuse of women in interpersonal relationships often happens concurrently with the abuse of companion animals. And there's been some really amazing, eye-opening statistics that have come out lately about that. Another way is in terms of objectification or commodification in mainstream imagery, like imagery in advertising. And I've actually developed a slideshow that that demonstrates how both animals and women are objectified or commodified in mainstream imagery. And another way is through language, through epithets, demeaning epithets, and other sort of linguistic mechanisms that both women and animals experience as part of their oppression. So there's a number of ways currently in which sexism and animal oppression are connected. And also historically, there's been an argument that pastoralism, or in other words, the keeping of livestock, arose concurrently with patriarchy, or in other words, male control of societies. So that's another issue that some people, are researching and have brought up. So there's many different connections there, and like I said, we could probably get...
Let's deal with just some of the issues that you've mentioned here. One of them is, of course, that in these, what you have in common with the female issue here is that the commonality is that someone becomes something in advertising, like it's commodified, and women fall under that bracket, and the animals do too. We had this same issue here with the hippopotami here. You know, it's someone, something special, becomes just another item which is used for the purpose of promoting a particular objective. But what I wanted to ask you was, we have the system of feminism. That's why I'm so drawn to what you're doing in your in your webpage, crossingthespeciesborder.org. We'll just mention that a few times so people can make a note of it, crossingthespeciesborder.org, is that women are much, and female animals have something in common here, and one of them is that the cow's reproductive system is the foundation of the whole milk industry.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe you want to just enlarge on it, because we have the same item with the gestation of pigs. I mean, it's female pigs, you know, that the males are slaughtered right away. That the female animals have to endure a lifetime of agony and silence.
Right.
And it's there's a commonality there with many women that are so abused in our society.
Right. It's very true. One thing that most people aren't aware of is that the vast majority of instances of conditions of reproductive control don't occur within human society. They actually occur within animal society. In other words, humans inflicting reproductive control on animals. Well, and also on the rest of the non-human world. So we tend to think of reproductive control as a human rights issue, but it's actually an issue that expands far beyond just human rights. here in the U.S., our federal legislation that legalizes abortion, which has been around for the past 33 years, is now under attack by the state of South Dakota, who recently, which recently decided to ban most abortions in their state. And so there's a lot of concern right now about reproductive justice here in the U.S. But, you know, likewise, there should be at least equally as much concern about the abuse of female animals' reproductive systems. And like you said, you know, controlling cows' reproductive systems is the foundation of the dairy industry. Cows are forced to produce over 100 times as much milk as they would normally produce. And that leads to, you know, solitary or intensive confinement. It leads to infections such as mastitis or laminitis and leukemia, bovine immunodeficiency disorder, all kinds of problems that lead to great physical pain and suffering for those animals. Another issue I just wanted to bring up quickly is that chickens, egg-laying hens, are also greatly abused in the sense that they're often subjected to what's called forced molting in factory farms, which means that they're denied food and light for up to 2 weeks sometimes, which synchronizes their egg-laying cycles, and that's a way of manipulating, again, manipulating their reproductive systems.
And so also what they do with these hens, because we're coming on to this egg season here, and people should know about this, that the hens, of course, the subjectation of the females again, and is that food and water is also withheld to these hens, and that serves as a shock to their bodies and sets off another egg-laying cycle.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
That's another abuse of the female animal species.
Mm-hmm.
Then we have the horses as well, of course.
Right, Premarin. Right, most people don't understand that Premarin is actually a contraction of pregnant mare's urine. So Premarin, you know, is derived from pregnant mare's urine, which means that like dairy cows, mares that are used to produce Premarin are kept impregnated. Artificially inseminated, and so they're, you know, that taxes their bodies, and they're also kept in intensive confinement, and sometimes left in cold weather conditions, and you know, really, really exploited in ways that are similar to how dairy cows are exploited.
Now, you give seminars. You go all over North America. You give seminars. We'll mention your webpage again. It's www.crossingthespeciesborder.org. If anybody would like to know more about what Helen Matthews is presenting here today, you go all over North America doing presenting workshops. When you do your workshops and you show this link between the animals and the subjugation of the female genders in humans and animals, and we also see that, you know, people think women are liberated, you know, it's feminism has done its thing, but has it really, when one considers that only 1% of the, somewhere, 1% of the land is owned by females in the world? I mean, it's just such an unequal opportunity everywhere on the male species for the female species all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe you can just enlarge on your view on that.
Well, you know, I'm definitely more familiar with what's happening in the U.S. than in other countries, and so unfortunately, I'm not, you know, the best person to talk about what's going on globally. But I do know that. That one thing that's happening is that there's been an expansion of factory farming into countries that traditionally don't have much factory farming. So, especially through trade agreements like the Central American Free Trade Agreement (CAFTA), which was recently approved in the U.S. Congress, that liberalizes trade between the U.S. and seven Central American countries. And that means that factory farms are bound to spread into those countries more than they already have. And that displaces the current farming practices, which are subsistence farming, and replaces subsistence farming with cash crop farming that's aimed at exports. And women traditionally have been more involved in subsistence farming than in cash crop export farming or, you know, mega farms, factory farms, corporate farms. So, you know, as we have this expansion of factory farming into other countries, we also have, an abuse there to women as well.
So when you've done seminars and I invite people to have a look at your pictures, then what do they come away with? What is the view?
It depends a lot. I think that for everyone, it plants a seed so that they're more aware of that type of the objectification or commodification of women and animals in popular media. So that they're more aware of that when they see it in the future. But for some people, it really hits a nerve. There are some people who just seem to have sort of understood this all along, but they never really had a name for it, or they never really discussed it with anyone. And then when they see the slideshow or the presentation crossing the species border, it sets off a spark in their mind. I've definitely seen that happen. It depends on, I guess, where the person is at, but it definitely can have a real eye-opening.
Now, Helen, the feminist movement has, in the last 15 years, it's a general awareness of what the issues are, even though so much still needs to be done to correct what's not right. But when you compare the feminist movement and the animal rights movement for equality or recognition, what can the animal rights people learn from the feminist movement? Because of a relative acceptance of the issue worldwide. What can animal rights people learn from you people?
Right. Oh, goodness, that's a great question. The animal rights movement, I think, can learn a lot from the feminist movement. The feminist movement has gone, at least in the U.S., has gone through at least three different waves. The first wave, the second wave, and the third wave, which we're in now. And so right there, I think that's, that's an eye-opener to animal rights activists. I think that we can realize that the animal rights movement really only started in this country in the 70s. And so, in a sense, we may still be in the first wave of the animal rights movement, and potentially we have other waves coming ahead of us. Another thing that I think the animal rights movement can learn from the feminist movement is in looking at how the feminist movement has really gone hand in hand with civil rights and anti-racist struggles in the U.S. So, for example, the Seneca Falls Convention in the 1800s, where Mary Wollstonecraft issued, her Declaration of the Rights of Women, that went hand in hand with the emancipation movement, right, in the end of U.S. slavery. And then fast forward to the 1950s, when you have the beginning of the second wave of U.S. feminism, that was going along at the same time as the burgeoning civil rights movement here, the struggle against racism. So that's not just coincidental. That's because there's a logic to liberation, where when you start to realize that one group is oppressed and that that's unjust, it's hard to not also see how other groups have been oppressed and how that's unjust as well. And so I think the animal rights movement can also realize that, maybe we've also been influenced by other liberation struggles, and maybe we also can work in tandem with those.
That's wonderful, Helen. You know, just in closing here, I'd just like to say that what you've done and what I see you've done is you've explored the relationship between sexism and the oppression of animals, and by encouraging discussion and analysis, and in this debate, you've created a strategy for social change. What could be more wonderful?
Thank you. Thank you. That's very kind. And certainly, if anyone would like to invite their workshop to their community, it's more than available to travel and visit wherever you are.
Give us a reference there, how people can contact you.
They can contact me by writing to crossingthespeciesborder@yahoo.com.
And the webpage is www.crossingthespeciesborder.org. Thank you, Helen, for being on Animal Voices.
Thank you, Carl. I really appreciate it.
Good. And over to Alan Jensen, and we'll be back with Anthony Marr. And we need to know some more of the information from his worldwide experience. And we'll just have a little tune from Alan Jensen. You're listening to Animal Voices, coming to you on CFRO Radio 102.7, and we have six people in here in the studio. We'll give them all a chance now to ask Anthony Marr, who's such a wonderful person who speaks out for the animals. He's spoken out for the tigers in India. He's spoken out about the seals, the whales, and many issues. And so, what we'll do now is we'll cover some of the seal issues, because the seal hunt is starting off here. And you've written a letter to the Prime Minister, but we'll just maybe just cover that a little bit here. Or maybe, how about Paul McCartney was interviewed on Larry King. What was your opinion on that? And then he was interviewed... Paul McCartney was interviewed by the Premier of Newfoundland. Some comments on that, Anthony Marr.
A debate. That's what happened.
Yeah, he was debated against. He debated against the Premier of Newfoundland, Danny Williams, who, well, of course, I'm a little bit biased, but I think that Paul McCartney and Heather Mills McCartney won hands down, and Danny Williams didn't need any good opponent to lose, because he's such an absolute poor presenter, and his.
Tell us what's his case. What does he say? How does he defend the seal slaughter?
Well, he defended it by pumping out all sorts of fallacies and unprovable, unsupportable statements, saying that the seal hunt is humane and that it is highly sustainable, and that he's actually doing the seals a favor by killing off 5 million of them so that they wouldn't starve.
wonderful,
etc. So, you know, it's whatever he says, the opposite is true.
Now, is it humane? And he's saying it is humane, and he's mentioning figures here. And you did an editorial about comparison with horses. Let's have it. Let's have it.
Well, I'm glad you read it. Well, I wrote an e-announcement to the animal rights community, as well as to a lot of newspapers in Canada, asking the question, are there 7,000 horses in Canada that are skinned alive every year? And that would be absolutely horrendous, and everybody would object to it, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. You know, cats and dogs are being hideously tortured before they're being killed for meat, but that is not in Canada, it's in Korea. In Canada, can we possibly tolerate life skinning of 7,000 horses? Yeah. And of course not. However, if you substitute the word horse with the word seals, killing 7,000 seals inhumanely and skinning it alive is highly acceptable, highly even respectable and promotable. Now, why 7,000? It's because Denny Williams very proudly announced on the on that Larry King interview that group of veterinarians who went to observe the hunt concluded that 98% of the seals are killed humanely. So he's saying rah rah rah, but if you look at it with a mirror, you'll see that he's saying that 2% of it are killed inhumanely, including being skinned alive. Now, I believe that being skinned alive is on a pain scale is probably on a par with being burnt alive at a stake, probably. And if you don't believe me, next time you get a hangnail, you rip it backwards and see how it feels. Just imagine being skinned. Your entire body being subjected to it, I think it would be unimaginably painful. And he is trying to justify that life skinning of 7,000 baby seals by statistics. That is his weapon. And, of course, 2% doesn't sound half or even 1% as bad as 7,000. But if you line up 7,000 life-skinned seals in a straight line, 1 meter each, it is 7 kilometers long. That is 35 city blocks, and I would invite Mr. Williams to walk that 35 blocks as a meditative experience and see what he comes up with.
Now, we know Paul Martin went to this Newfoundland as an election promise, giving support to the seal slaughter and hunt. Now, are we any better off now with a change of government?
Well, Stephen Harper is still a bit of a question mark, even though the Department of Fisheries and Oceans remain, even though they've got a new minister now, it remains as barbaric as ever. I don't know if it's going to be more barbaric than before. I find it very hard to imagine, but I have got news that the seal hunt is taking place. There was a couple of days of questioning in regards to the seal hunt being cancelled because of the global warming sort of thinning out the ice, and it is unsafe for the sealers to walk onto. And but now they are announcing that the seal hunt is going to take place, even though it may be a little bit later. The St. Lawrence Seaway hunt is going to be opening first, and then the bigger hunt later. There was a smaller hunt somewhere else outside of Canada that has already started. I think it's in Greenland. I'm sorry about that, but. There was going to be a hunt this year, I know that.
So the jury is out about the Conservatives, Mrs. Hunt, Mrs. Harper, Harp Seals.
Well, you know, that's good. That's good. Well, you know, there's another thing that is good, too, and that is Stephen Harper. Mrs. Harper is an animal lover, and she has been working with SPCA and taking in dogs into her own home. Wow. For placement. And we're hoping that with an enlightened wife, and I hope that Helen is listening in. I'm praising the women of our society. That Mrs. Harper is probably more enlightened than Mr. Harper, and she hopefully will have some influence on her. So far, Mr. Harper himself has not made a public statement that I've heard in regards to the seal hunt, but the DFO is saying that they're going to hunt. So.
And when is it starting? You said it's delayed now. Is it?
Well, usually it starts around the middle of March, about this time, maybe in a week or two. But I heard that they may have to delay it until April, but I'm not sure.
Now, will the good ship Marley Farley Mowat be there?
Captain Watson did say that he's going to take on a seal hunt this year, but I don't know whether he's going to take a ship.
He had his wings clipped a little bit by the experience last year. Maybe just give us a quick recap what happened there and what injustices the government belayed on these people who wanted to save the seals. I mean, this is a total, I think, defamation of justice here.
Okay, first of all, Captain Watson has an infinite supply of wings to be clipped. When he'll keep on flying, but the injustice is Canadian law. People, Canadian listeners, please listen. That Canadian law has it that the Seal Protection Act is a big misnomer. It should be Sealers Protection Act. It is illegal to go and cuddle a seal or touch a seal. In fact, Paul McCartney and Heather was violating a law by touching a baby seal. And whereas killing a seal is not only legal, but is being protected by the Coast Guard at taxpayers' expense. So
you won't believe it, but we've only got 2 minutes left here, and we're told to wrap it up.
Okay.
But quickie question, Marge, yeah, and John.
Other than Mrs. Harper, maybe that's a glimmer of light, but are there any other positive signs regarding the seal hunting in Canada?
Yes, and big. And that is what it started last year, and that is an international orchestrated cooperative collective boycott against Canadian seafood. Let's put things in perspective. The seal hunt brings in about $16 million into the Canadian economy, $16 million. As a result of the boycott up to this point, and lots of U.S. seafood merchants and restaurants and chains have already joined the boycott, and the boycott is costing the Canadian snow cap industry up to this point $150 million. That's 10 times loss to the one-time gain from the seals.
John, we've got 1 minute left here.
And the Inuit Circumpolar Conference, what can you say about them?
Well, the Inuits are trying to get... I don't know much about that conference, but the Inuits is heard to say that he would like to invite Paul McCartney there to debate their hunt, and they are actually defending the Canadian seal hunt.
These are Greenland Inuit.
Oh, are they?
I don't know whether Canadians are involved in that. This is a conference, but...
I am not.
We're right out of time here. Remind you about the International Day of Action for the Seals on Wednesday, March the 15th at 401 Burrard Street between 12 and 2 p.m. Thank you, Alan Jensen.
May I give credit to the organizer? The organizer is several people, primarily Stephen Thompson, who is a member of the Sea Shepherd Society.
Thank you. And you've been listening to Animal Voices, www.animalvoices.org. Thank you for listening.